Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the January 22nd, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, Objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here are the topics I have planned. First, an article called The Rise of the New Groupthink from the New York Times. We'll talk about what it has to say. I thought it was a surprisingly good article considering New York Times, and it's giving me a couple new books on my reading list. Second, Saudi Arabia signs a nuclear cooperation pact with China. Of course, it's only for peaceful purposes. Third, Islamic parties are the big winners in Egypt's elections, and we'll talk about that. Why Apple ships jobs overseas. Some of the reasons might surprise you. And more. Of course, we have a little bit of politics and stuff too. Those of you who are attending live, please feel free to call in and weigh in on these topics. The number is 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. And you can also give some input in the chat room. I see a number of you are already there. Hello, and a couple of regulars, so that's nice. Martin starts off with a comment. Nuclear cooperation means peace. So it's going to be another fun day here on this show.
I have to bite my tongue. So
yeah, actually, we're not supposed to be able to come up with anything good in a group. Not really. That's not what this article says. But the article that I have is actually from January 13th. So if I was really on my toes, I would have had it for you last week. But I discovered it since the show last week. And it's called The Rise of the New Groupthink, and it's written by a woman named Susan Cain, who has a book coming out on this topic. And I can't actually remember the title of her forthcoming book right now. Here it is, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. That's the title, which I find very intriguing. And this article is of particular interest to me because, as many of you know, I've done a lot of work on privacy. I've done more work actually on the political right to privacy than I have on the value of privacy, but I've done some work on that in the past as well. I wrote a piece called The Freedom of Disassociation and Anthem that had some themes with respect to that, reflected there. And recently, this has been the topic of my research. In fact, I read Steve Jobs' book in part, I mean, I was going to do it anyway, but in part because I wanted to learn what the value of privacy was to him in terms of enhancing his life, not just his productivity, but his life in general. And unfortunately, I found little or nothing explicitly mentioned in that book about it. But as Susan Cain talks about in this piece, the book that I should look at is Steve Wozniak's people are talking about the Patriots in the chat room. I'm sorry if we're competing with football or something again. I don't know. Patriots are going to the Super Bowl is the news that we're getting in there for those of you who are disconnected from your beloved football. So I need to look at the Wozniak biography, obviously, because what Susan Cain talks about in part is Steve Wozniak, his ability
co-founder of Apple.
Yeah, he was. I hope everyone knows he's the co-founder of Apple, and he was actually the inventor of the first Apple computer. He would not be able to do this, he said, without having solitude. So this article, The Rise of the New Groupthink, starts out. She says, solitude is out of fashion. Our companies, our schools, and our culture are enthralled to an idea that I call the new groupthink, which holds that creativity and achievement come from an oddly gregarious place. Most of us now work in teams, in offices without walls, for managers who prize people's skills above all. Lone geniuses are out, collaboration is in. And she says, the problem with this is that, and I'm skipping down
not
a little,
true.
Yeah, she says, the most spectacularly creative people in many fields are often introverted. They're not joiners by nature. There's been some studies by psychologists, and one psychologist, Hans Eysenck, I think is how you pronounce it, he says, introversion fosters creativity by, quote, concentrating the mind on the tasks in hand and preventing the dissipation of energy on social and sexual matters unrelated to work, end quote. And then Steve Wozniak, of course, is known for toiling on the invention of the personal computer alone. A quote from Wozniak, he says, most inventors and engineers I've met are like me. They live in their heads. They're almost like artists. In fact, the very best of them are artists, and artists work best alone. I'm not going to give you some advice that might be hard to take. That advice is, I'm going to give you some advice that might be hard to take. That advice is work alone, not on a committee, not on a team. End quote. Now, what Susan Cain is talking about is that everywhere people seem to be putting students, business people, everyone into groups, trying to force you into groups. And the worst example in here is that she said she visited a fourth grade classroom in New York City in which the rule was that, first of all, students engaged in group work, which when I've taught, I do not have group work. The most that I've ever had in my classes is that I will have students give feedback to each other on their individually written papers. That's the most that I've done. But if, for instance, you go to a business school, it's very common in business schools to have people work in teams on team projects. And then, of course, what happens? One of them just kind of sits back and lets the other one do the work. And people also don't want to disagree. They don't come up with their own ideas. Cain mentions in this article somewhere that there's an actual chemical that is released in our brains that makes us wary of disagreeing with others when we're in groups. So there's, all kinds of chemistry goes on. Anyway, in this one fourth grade classroom, they have the students working in groups, and then they have the rule that no student can ask a question. No student in any group can ask a question unless all the students in that group have the same question.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Luke in the chat room says, in college, he lost points in some classes for not attending group work recitations. Right. Yeah, I don't see what the value of this group work is. Now, if you have a group of students that want to get together and study, I think it can sometimes be beneficial, but the little bit of group work that I did, it was because students wanted me to help them with a particular economics class. I got all the benefit out of it, I think, because I was teaching them, and whenever you have to teach something, you learn it so much better. There's one place that I was a little surprised that kind of adopts this new group think, says Cain. She reports that mega churches these days feature extracurricular groups organized around every conceivable activity, from parenting to skateboarding to real estate, and expect worshipers to join in. So when they get you in these little groups, I guess all your individuality goes away and you tend to absorb the religious doctrine more. I don't know exactly what. Now, she says some teamwork is fine and offers a fun, stimulating, useful way to exchange ideas, manage information, and build trust. She says, but it's one thing to associate with a group in which each member works autonomously on his piece of the puzzle. It's another to be corralled into endless meetings or conference calls conducted in offices that afford no respite from the noise and gaze of coworkers. She says, studies show that open plan offices make workers hostile, insecure, and distracted. They're also more likely to suffer from high blood pressure, stress, the flu, and exhaustion. And people whose work is interrupted make 50% more mistakes and take twice as long to finish it. Now, none of us know that problem at all, right? Interruptions from email, Facebook, Twitter, text messages. It just makes you work faster and better, right, Bosch? What do you think?
I don't know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I can't hear you. I'm looking at something on Facebook.
Actually, he's looking at his phone right now while I'm talking to him. So this is very bad.
I have a good story.
I do like this one example. There was something, and I think I've heard about this before. It's called the coding war games, where I guess they're given a certain problem that they have to code in computer language, and they see how fast and accurately all these different people can perform it. And they said of the people who competed in the coding war games, what was it? It was 62% of the best performers said their workspace was sufficiently private, compared with only 19% of the worst performers. And then in terms of interruptions, it says 76% of the worst programmers, but only 38% of the best said that they were often interrupted needlessly. End quote. So privacy and lack of interruptions are huge if you want to be productive. Now, for me, I was always the kind of student that I could not even listen to music in the background when I did my homework. I understand with drawing, for instance,
I can't. Yeah. I have to be totally focused when I draw. Definitely talk radio, music, audiobooks.
Right. Once you're to the stage of drawing
exactly.
something, you
Once
can do it.
Once it's already established that I know what the story is and I'm just designing and
But for me, I mean, I remember students in my classes, and I was a math major undergrad, and math got challenging and difficult for me. But I think even when math was still easy for me, when I was in high school, junior high, you know, at those levels of math, I could not listen to music while I was doing these math problems. Now, maybe some people are just smarter. I don't know. But
Well, you got to be focused.
Yeah, for me, I just like to get everything kind of drowned out. Brainstorming sessions, writes Kane, are one of the worst possible ways to stimulate creativity. Mm-hmm. And they did a study, and they said that in terms of getting ideas for a money-raising campaign, you got way more ideas if people worked on it alone versus in groups, contrary to what you see on Mad Men when they all sit around a table and try to brainstorm these ideas.
Well, I think that's when the brainstorming idea broke through and became famous, you know, I think in the 50s and 60s.
Now, in terms of her recommendations, she says really we need to have both drives. That she says on the one hand, we love and need one another, yet we crave privacy and autonomy. And she says to harness the energy that fuels both these drives, we need to move beyond the new groupthink and embrace a more nuanced approach to creativity and learning. She says our offices should encourage casual cafe-style interactions, but allow people to disappear into personalized private spaces when they want to be alone. And similar analogies for schools and school children. And she describes at the end Steve Wozniak's working environment when he worked at Hewlett-Packard. He said that every day at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., Hewlett-Packard management wheeled in donuts and coffee, and then people could socialize and swap ideas. And it was a very low-key thing so that he could just go back to work when he wanted. Nobody cared. Nobody was offended when he goes back to work. You know, sometimes you have this idea. I find it funny, though. It seems, at least in my experience, in academia, you're almost always given an office with a door to close and things like that. And if academics realize that you need an office and a door to close in order to be able to think, why don't they realize that it's true in a work environment as well? Is it that they have disdain for people who work in business as if, you know, business is not important, that it doesn't require thought and concentration, and academia, the exalted people, they require this? I don't even know. Now, we've got some people contributing here in the chat.
She wrote this book with her family, right?
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, here, and she even says, though, she says sometimes there are great breakthroughs made in some areas of academia with groups.
No doubt about it.
But she specifies, she says a lot of times those team members collaborate remotely from separate universities.
Right.
And so then you can communicate electronically, maybe through an email discussion list or something.
Right.
Where
and
each
you're focused
person,
on the job. You're not focused on chit-chat and whatnot. You're focused on the job.
Yeah, and you're usually focused on your individual part, and then you report to somebody else. So Some people are very happy about the Super Bowl, and now we're talking about the group work in the chat room here. Yeah, Luke says, it was annoying because if I understood the material well, then I would spend the group work session explaining it to others. Uh-huh. Now, see, Luke made the mistakes. So what happened with me is there was some economics class. This one professor had his own economic theory. And for whatever reason, I understood it completely. It was super easy for me. And so people actually hired me to teach it to them in a little group session. So you just should have been hired. Mm-hmm. You should have gotten money from
it. That's right.
I don't think I got very much money, but it was still kind of cool. It was the first time I was paid to teach.
You should use the force, Luke.
Luke should have used the force. You're so mean.
Me.
And then he says, if he didn't understand the material, then he'd be distracted by the group. Yeah, of course. And then, and right. That's the thing. I ask this of students. I have a class that I'm teaching right now on privacy law. And I spoke about this article in that class this week. And I asked the students whether
Did any of them read it? Just out of curiosity.
I don't think they had read it.
Okay.
The one thing about law students that you have to understand is I think they just live isolated existences. They are taking four different law classes at once, and they're just buried in tons and tons of reading for each class. So the idea of reading something extracurricular for a law student is just nuts. And so
this is pretty relevant, though.
This is definitely relevant in terms of the value of privacy, not so much the law.
Published in the New York Times. I'm reading. I'm like, this is the New York Times. I had to double check.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's a great piece, and very interested in the book.
I'm definitely interested in the book as well. The book is going to be focusing more on solitude itself.
What's called,
I mean, for the solitude for the introvert. It's quiet. The power of introverts in a world that can't stop talking. So.
Well, it doesn't want to quiet the power of introverts. It's quiet.
Yes.
And then the
quiet colon the power of introverts.
Right.
Yeah. No, not quiet the power of introverts. I mean, I was surprised with this, but in terms of my students. I try to get them to say whether they got value from studying in groups. And it depends on how each person manages himself in that group setting. Some people put on their earplugs or their headphones and they tune other people out.
But also, people want to believe that that's true. The brainstorming and collaborating, it's all good and true because it's, again, the kind of mentality that people are raised with. Work well with others. That's a great virtue, a great quality. So people don't want to, even if they know it, personally, that the opposite side is true. They still maybe want to believe that. So
yeah,
I think maybe your students said, yeah, it's great brainstorming with others when it actually might not be, even for them.
Yeah, and there, some people did. They would get some value from these group study sessions, and some no. When I was in law school, studied completely alone, made all my own outlines. I trusted only myself to take the good notes.
Right.
I mean, you know what you need yourself in order to memorize a body of material as well. Now, we've really got the discussion. We're getting behind here on our chat room duty, Bosch. This is sadness. And then Derek says, educators wonder incredulously why so many of their smartest students don't care about school and so many smart teenagers drop out of high school. Yeah, I don't know how much group work they're forcing people into in the lower grades now, but having fourth graders, I mean, they're learning a lot of important things, hopefully, at that age. I mean, I don't know what the curriculum is like in the public schools, but to throw them in group sessions and to say that they cannot ask a question unless everybody in the group has the identical question, that is stifling their cognition.
I mean, it's unbelievable. And to get to that point, I mean, it's like, what kind of corruption led to that? I mean, it's incredible.
Martin also mentions in terms of a downside of group work that it puts a heavier burden on the individuals because they have to carry others in order to get the grade.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And that's what these group thinkers might be thinking. Like, well, they expect others to be lazy, so they want the productive ones, take over. But now, give them credit.
Now, Derek is reporting that it's probably a well-known management principle that brainstorming and creating is done better alone. It's good if they're learning this finally, because if you do, you watch Mad Men, you make it think, you would think that they're coming up with all these advertising ideas.
But ultimately,
in these groups,
it's Don Draper on his own.
Right.
Pondering something.
Right.
And then he comes up. And then so.
It's been so long since we got to watch Mad Men.
But ultimately, that's, the brainstorming, he's almost bothered by it also, if you notice. He's like, come on. Yeah.
Now, Luke said he tried to get paid doing people's homework in sixth grade and got in trouble for it. So, see, that's the wrong that's the wrong idea. But, I mean, on the right track, right? On the right track. Derek says, having to watch students be taught things you already know can be hell for the more intelligent students. Yes, and so then you'll have a lot of them who will just drop out. Clearly, I think the best strategy is to teach probably for the middle of the class and offer plenty of help for students who are beyond the progress of the class so that they need extra challenges.
Some don't give a damn.
And those who need remedial help.
Some just don't give a damn.
Well, of course, but you're not going to offer extra help to people who don't give a damn. I mean, unless you feel like it's your job to motivate them as well. Yeah, collaborative settings, values. Some people say they'll never co-author a work. I don't know. I haven't had too much experience co-authoring. Yeah. Derek says he knows firsthand that a major reason that so many intelligent young people are cynical and lazy is because of the stifling groupthink that they're pushed into in education.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you may as well spend your time smoking pot and playing World of Warcraft. That's WOW.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Oh, I think that's what it's... That's
I thought it was War of Words, because that's one... And Phil, number two, I have this War of Words with your brothers. That's how I've always been. W-O-W.
You've got your work on the brain. Right. If school's just going to be boring and stifling, yeah, who blames them? Who blames them? Now, Martin says that the core problem is the idea of having people in schools organized after age rather than ability and ambition. I would say yes and no. Students who skip so many grades, if they skip too many grades, sometimes it is hard. It just depends on the child and how they're doing developmentally and socially too. So, you know, I think there are some reasons to group students according to age, but I think it should be more variable than it is in terms of ability. They shouldn't, you know, rigidly put you in there. But
hang on a second, Derek, Amy was right. She called it
World of Warcraft.
World of Warcraft, right.
Right.
And my thing is W-O-W is War of Words between the brothers in my story. I have that in my head. That's how I always put it in my notes. So Amy was right. Just for record. That's all.
So I was right once?
Yes. You were right in this particular point. Yeah.
Excellent. I'm very happy to be right. So in general, chat room users, I'm sort of preaching to the choir on this issue, it sounds like.
I guess, but it's just great, again, to see in New York Times a leftist rag like that.
Yeah.
It's excellent.
And the other thing that I'm looking forward to with the book is the actual studies.
Wow.
Because, I mean, here you've just got a short piece in New York Times, and then when you get
right.
the book, you're going to be able to see the details of the study.
When they do studies, it goes into reality. It goes into truth. They can't, even if they don't want it. It's like there was a couple doing a book on race in America, and the conclusion was that a lot of it has been wiped out. And they didn't necessarily believe that going in. But they ended up saying, well, the results are what they are. I mean, that's it.
Right.
So maybe the same thing happened here, possibly.
Yeah, and of course, there are themes like this in 1984 and also in Ayn Rand's Anthem for people who are familiar as well.
I relate.
Now, Martin says I made a valid point about what?
Well, you made a number of valid points.
I thought I made a few good valid points, but a valid point about the education, about stratifying in terms of age, that
right.
it's not completely unrelated to anything in reality that in terms of the needs of education of a student. You know, ideally, you could have all students homeschooled, and then there would be a certain amount of extracurricular social interaction that might take the place of,
you know,
some of the socializing that happens during school.
Schools, they're always trying to direct us in a certain way.
Yeah.
They're trying to, you know, wipe us out, wipe out our minds.
And I think that's what a lot of homeschooling parents do, is you just tailor whatever, you know, the level of instruction is to the abilities of your child, but then you're going to go ahead and put them in gymnastics or
right.
maybe music instruction. You know, music, they could also become proficient very quickly, too.
I wonder if she does private schools, public schools, and the differences if she comes across.
Yeah,
that,
here she just talks about, you know, the New York
the book,
school that she went
I hope
to. But
she does that because it's indoctrination, period. At least public schools.
Well, I was just very glad to see somebody question this. I've had an aversion to group work for years, and as I said, I've never assigned group work. Everybody's getting an individual grade. I've never had group grades for anything. Right. Oh, what do we have here? A test for Mensa and stuff. They're all talking about what their intellectual ability is. Okay, well, we'll just change the subject. I don't want to share my IQ scores or whatever.
I want to share mine, but I won't. That's fine.
You are evil. You're totally evil. We don't have a caller on this, and they're in the chat room. They're saying my IQ is bigger than yours. So we have some smart people in the chat room. So this is a good thing. Let's go on to our next story. Unless people have some more. Oh no, just Martin. Martin's the only one with the IQ test. Actually, I don't even know if there's a 600 IQ. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. I got a pretty good one, but I'm not gonna say it.
I mean, and there's a million different IQ tests, too.
Absolutely.
Some tests for one thing, some tests for another. Okay, so next story, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's in the news this week because with China, it signed a nuclear cooperation pact. I've got the Wall Street Journal story from the 16th of January. It says top oil exporter Saudi Arabia said Monday that it inked an agreement.
Top oil exporter, not top... terrorism sponsor?
No, they don't even talk about that here. It says it inked an agreement with China to enhance cooperation between the two countries in the development and use of atomic energy for peaceful purposes.
And they have to put it that way.
Right.
Because it's not for peaceful purposes. That's why.
And they're going to have cooperation in areas like maintenance and development of nuclear power plants and research reactors. Research reactors. Manufacturing and supply of nuclear fuel elements, end quote. Research reactor sounds
peaceful.
Sounds
peaceful.
A little suspicious. The story contains a bunch of statistics showing why they have this need for nuclear power. It's a desert kingdom. They have a booming population, developing economy, and this all constrains the government's ability to provide electricity and water. And while keeping the demand for domestic oil at bay, it says that if they have this energy consumption growth rate of 7% a year and it continues unabated, that within 20 years they're going to burn the equivalent of around 2/3 of their crude production output, so that they have this need for the nuclear energy. So see, you're supposed to believe it's peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
Skip down a little more. It says Saudi Arabia plans to spend more than $100 billion on 16 nuclear reactors planned to be built by 2030 to meet its growing domestic energy needs. The kingdom's former Saudi intelligence chief and former ambassador to Washington, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, said last year. So 16 reactors to be built by 2030.
Well, in 2008, Bush tried to help them get nukes. Why? Why? You know the difference between the Saudis and the Iranians is the Saudis take Muhammad's counsel seriously when he said war is deceit. The Iranians, we want to wipe you off the face of the earth. The Saudis smile, pretend to be your friends, and want to kill us.
Last I checked, the Saudis were a leading state sponsor of terrorism.
Yeah, of course, and they're the greatest state sponsor of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
That's a fact. But... No.
Now listen to this article.
Sorry, they bought American politicians for the last 40 to 50 years, probably more in the last 30, 40 years. Powerful ones.
And
right.
George W. Bush has his Saudi-funded library in his name
and
as well.
And also Clinton does.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the Bush senior. They own them. You know.
So there's this one paragraph in the Wall Street Journal story. Listen to this. They say the cooperation agreement between Saudi Arabia and China comes amid intensifying international pressure on Iran over its controversial atomic energy program, which the Islamic Republic says is only for peaceful purposes, while the U.S. and other Western states suspect it's aimed at developing nuclear weapons capabilities. So then you'd think the next paragraph would be about similar concerns with respect to Saudi Arabia, right? Analogous concerns?
Exactly right.
No, they have a rapid change of subject. And instead
they've not only bought politicians, they bought media, they bought, you know, everything.
I mean, it's just interesting. So they have that paragraph, and then they go into China wants to play a larger role in the global nuclear industry, like I care. I mean, I guess we sort of care because China's not our best friend either.
No.
So there's not a single mention of whether they're going to have nuclear weapons or somebody talking about how likely it is. The words that I picked up in here are that they're going to have research reactors. Those research reactors, I assume, could help enrich uranium to the weapons grade or whatever it is.
15 of the 19 hijackers, not 11 were Saudis. Most of the suicide bombers in Iraq were Saudis. And, you know, in the reports in the last 10 years, they found out that there were Saudis. There was Saudi involvement with 9/11, with individuals, with family members, because who knows how many family members there are in the royal family? Thousands and thousands. So who knows? But it's just they have bought the right people in America and the West, and that's why they get a pass.
And you said that this trial recently in which some private parties had sued Iran and Saudi Arabia for involvement in 9/11, that they had gotten a favorable ruling, at least in one level of the courts, right?
I mean, basically, they're doing the government's job. You know, the government was supposed to take care of these two countries, but they didn't. And I remember PBS years ago, not long after 9/11, one politician went on the show and said, we know two countries that were involved in 9/11, but we won't know for 20 years, meaning the public will not know for 20 years. And we know who those two countries are. And you hear things like that, and you blow a fuse. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. And so here we are. I've heard this story this week. What have you heard in terms of reaction to this story?
Nothing.
Nothing?
They're focused on Iran. We got to be focused on both of them. They're the twin, you know, threats.
And
both of them.
And do you think that there's no focus on Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely not.
They own part of Fox News.
Yeah, they own Fox News. They own this. They own that. They own land in here. They know who to buy. They knew who to buy, and they bought them. You know.
And
for decades. And
it's a Saudi prince to whom Obama bowed.
Yes,
famously.
I think the
infamously.
King. I think the Saudi king.
The Saudi king.
And also, you know, Obama has members of the Muslim Brotherhood who work in the White House, literally.
And the Muslim Brotherhood is based in Saudi Arabia?
Well, no, it's in Egypt.
Okay.
That's the origins. That's the main. They were in the audience when Obama gave his submission speech in Egypt.
Right.
He knew that. The President of the United States of America knew that an enemy of the United States of America and of the West was in the audience. But to him, yeah.
Now, what have we got here in terms of a response in the chat room? Martin says, now to Saudi Arabia, preferably with bomber planes and ICBMs.
Well, we just sold them some fighter jets, a whole ton of fighter jets.
We sold it to Saudi Arabia.
To Saudi Arabia. Why? They can go with a pretext that, oh, we're trying to protect ourselves from Iran. Well, when it comes to Saudis and Iran, when it comes to the West, they're friends. Only when if they look for trouble with each other, as a different story. But when it comes to us, they're brothers.
Martin says we should have eliminated the twin threats in response for the destruction of the twin towers.
Those are the two big ones, two greatest state sponsors of terrorism on Earth, jihad terrorism. And until they become, until we make them quote unquote peaceful.
Well, and then the question is, what would, if you did a regime change in these countries, what would that even look like?
I don't know.
And that
we're so far away from it. It seems like it's years away. But we have to. They have to pay a price for killing Americans. I mean, it doesn't matter what it'll take. We have to keep ourselves safe. But Bush he was determined to protect Islam and Saudi Arabia after 9/11, more than anything. Us,
Now, you said he had done special things to make sure the Saudi families.
Well, Bin Laden's family was supposedly flown out of here on 9/11. And that was, secret. It was an open secret. Everyone knew about it. And he never had to answer for it. He also covered up the 9/11 report. He covered up literally 28 pages of the report that had to deal with state sponsored terrorism, meaning Saudi Arabia and Iran. He blacked those out. On executive order.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't pay a price for
that. I think Obama's got a State of the Union address coming up. You think he's going to talk a lot about this, right?
That's right. He's going to reveal it. No, this is, Bush is, because Bush, Obama, because of his disgusting presidency, we have Obama. And because of him, the enemy never paid the price. that they had to pay. We never got back to normal since 9/11. We're not normal. We haven't been normal for over a decade. The economy, the war, everything.
Let's see what in the chat room says. A $30 billion arms deal with Saudi Arabia, so it must be a record of some kind. And this is on the idea that Saudi Arabia is going to be the one that is going to be our ally against Iran, right?
Well,
that's the pretense? That's
also,
the
Saudis supposedly behind the scenes are okay with Israel taking out Iran because it's their competitor as far as they're concerned.
Well, that's until Iran's gone, and then Saudis are going to come back and be our enemies again, and they're going to use our weapons against us again.
Well, Saudis have always been our enemies.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they like living large, and they like going to America here and there, and they love going to meet the president. It's like Bush, he couldn't wait to get a Saudi prince at Crawford, I guess, 2001, right after 9/11, next day to say, hey, we're good. You know, he was, as far as I know, he was buddies with them for years, even before he was president because of his father.
Now, Obama canceled Keystone, says Derek, and I'm not sure exactly why he brought that up, but it's because we're not going to be dependent on oil if we can do something like Keystone, but Obama gets rid of it. I saw, it was a Washington Post piece about this, Derek, is they were critical of Obama for that decision, and Washington Post is known for being fairly liberal.
Oh, yeah.
But they said
they do have
there
sometimes.
Was no valid purpose whatsoever for Obama not allowing the Keystone Project to go
through. They're covering themselves because they can point back, hey, we were objective in this one point. And that's what they do sometimes. They have to be somewhat objective every so often, and that was their choice. If anyone wants to see a graphic I made, it's called Bucked Over, about how how our politicians have bucked us over by being bought by the Saudis and doing their bidding for decades.
Derek says, good thing that the U.S. can buy more oil from Saudi Arabia. Oh, I see, because, instead of hostile states like Canada. I would much rather give our money to Canada.
That was one pun. It's Saudi Arabia, S-O-W, you know, female pig. And Martin says Saudi Arabia. That's pretty funny. Shoddy Arabia, I guess one could say.
Shady Arabia.
Ozua says funny.
They're coming up. They're trying to have a pun contest in there. This is awesome.
So, Saudi Arapia, you know.
Azua in the chat room says that Saudis teach their high school kids to hate the West. I think they teach even earlier, probably.
Yeah, absolutely. From day one.
Yet some wacky analyst believes they can be a proper ally.
Well, they're not. They never have been. But, you know, there's this phrase, like, Islam is peace. Our friends, the Saudis. It's the same, you know, quote-unquote, our friends, the Saudis. It's one sentence. Bush has used it. Other politicians have used it. Our friends, the Saudis. You know.
I don't think that it's that much different there than other places in the Middle East, places about which people have been optimistic.
Well, that's the birthplace of Islam. It's a hellhole. I mean, you know, I got this one Saudi freak who visits my site. He always tries to post. He visits more than anyone. It's actually in the site meter.
Woohoo!
You know, the most popular visitor.
Top visitors.
And he always tries to, you know, put his vile crap in there. And
well, and then, of course, if you don't let it be posted, it's
censorship. As he called it, in a country that has censorship. Anyway, but he said, I said, I would tell him to go to hell, but that would be redundant, so.
Right. Well, this brings us into our next most pleasant story, which is that there were parliamentary elections in Egypt this week. Egypt, of course, is the poster child of the Arab Spring. So we're all very eager to see what the results of these first democratic elections, you know, the hope for freedom and prosperity, right? Individualism in
democracy.
Egypt, a secular form of government, right? Here's the story from the Wall Street Journal. Headline, January 21st, says, Islamic parties dominate Egypt parliamentary elections. Says the final results from Egypt's six-week parliamentary election cycle were announced on Saturday, confirming predictions that the country's first post-revolutionary parliament will be dominated by a small number of Islamist parties.
What parties?
Islamist.
Oh, not Islamic
parties. Big surprise.
Islamic parties.
I didn't write it.
I know.
Islamist political forces won close to a combined 70% of the seats in Egypt's first post-revolutionary parliament.
They've been itching to do it for 100 years.
Yeah.
The Brotherhood.
Well, and they're not all Brotherhood ones, okay? So this
I know, but they're the dominant ones.
Yeah, they are the dominant ones. It says the Freedom and Justice Party. This is what the Muslim Brotherhood's political arm is called. It's called the Freedom and Justice Party. They won 43.7% of the seats, or 218 out of 498. There is another one called the Nur Party, which is affiliated with the ultra-conservative Salafi stream of Islamist thought. Now, what do you know about the Salafis versus...
Well, I mean, when it comes down to it, they're all the same. You know, you got the little...
They all hate us equally?
Yeah, exactly.
Do they hate women equally?
Of course.
Okay.
They all support jihad except the freak sect called the Ahmadiyya sect, which is...
Yeah, they're not talking about the Ahmadiyya sect
at all. Well, they get killed because they reject jihad.
And if they describe party ultra. As ultra-conservative, what does that mean to you?
They're devout Muslims. I mean, that's what they are. But the Muslim Brotherhood are as well.
Praying,
Al-Qaeda as well.
More requirements to wear headscarves, burqas.
Less freedom, less peace.
Less driving for women.
You know, more Islam means less peace.
Yeah.
And that's what they want.
So the Nur Party won 108 seats, or 21.7%
of the parliament.
It's going
to Muslim hell. It's going to Islamic hell, Egypt.
Right.
And that's it. It's over.
And then it's a liberal party called Al-Waft Party. They were... They won more than 5% of the seats. But anyways, I guess those two are the ones that are the biggest of the two, and that already adds up to over 60-some-odd percent. I'm trying to see which one is the third of them. But it says that though Islamist politicians will enjoy clear dominance of the parliament, they are unlikely to vote as a single cohesive bloc.
Now, these quote-unquote Islamist parties, they refer to themselves as Islamist parties, right? They say, we are an Islamist, right? I mean, I can't stand that term. That's all. I'm sorry. Islamists, quote-unquote, don't call themselves Islamists. They call themselves Muslims.
Martin says, we need a party devoid of Muslims and not a party of devout Muslims. And it seems that that's what we've got in Egypt is a party of devout Muslims.
And they have their best friend in the White House.
Three different parties.
The Muslim Brotherhood has their best friend in the White House.
Yeah.
He's your best friend.
I'm just wondering is Obama going to try to spin this and talk in his State of the Union address about the first democratic elections in Egypt and how wonderful it is?
I don't know how he's going to show his face at the State of the Union. I don't know. How the hell can he walk up there and say anything? He'll have to spin everything he's done. Everything.
He just blocked Keystone, so
exactly right.
He can't say he's doing everything he can to help create jobs. He's going to try to blame the lack of job creation on the Congress that's obstructing his grand plans, right?
To getting us better on track. And he has the power to make sure that happens.
This in Egypt is his fault.
Absolutely right.
He helped encourage this stuff.
Did.
There's no doubt about it. So it's like
Carter with Iran.
Yeah,
he allowed Iran to go to hell, and it did.
So supposedly the only hope for Egypt is that
if they renounce Islam.
Well, that would be the only hope. But in terms of now, with all of these Islamist parties, as they call them, being the leaders in parliament, the only hope is that they don't vote as a single cohesive bloc.
And they go to war politically, yeah.
Yeah, so they politically go to war with each other because each of them wants to be the dominant one. It said in public statements, the Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party has said it hopes to lead a pluralistic legislature and has resisted suggestions that it would form a coalition with the conservative Salafi parties.
Where's the Women's Party? Where's it?
Yeah, the Women's Freedom for Women Party. Where is that one? They said this obviously before the election. Oh, yes, we want a pluralistic parliament. Then I love this paragraph of the story. It says, political analysts had expected the Islamist parties to do well in the elections, but were surprised by the strong showing of the hardline Salafi parties and by the poor performance of the political groups that were affiliated with the members of former President Mubarak's regime.
Mubarak, yeah.
Mubarak, Mubarak.
That's, yeah. Doesn't matter.
Potato, patata. In terms of the actual secular youth activists that we had so much hope for in Egypt, it's called the Revolution Continues Bloc. That's what they call themselves. It draws its ranks mainly from the youth activists and leftist political parties. They won only 8 seats, 1.6%.
And those who voted might be in trouble.
So any of the secular-minded, I think the other secular-minded party was called the National Democratic Party, and they got 3.6%.
I'll tell you, those people
so should, it's just pathetic.
They better get the hell out of Egypt now.
Well, and right, they do have some time, if I mean, assuming that they're able to do it now. It says that this new parliament has few immediate political powers. So it makes it sound like, if, right. you know, when you read that, it's just sort of a showpiece.
I think
because
this is
the,
a formality, though. The Muslim Brotherhood will take over, period. That's it. They'll be dominant.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So they say that right now, Egypt's Supreme Council of Armed Forces is in charge. And as of now, that Supreme Council of Armed Forces still has the final say on all the matters of state, so that the parliament is not, you know, it doesn't have immediate power right now to start cracking down mm-hmm. on women travel, all the horrible things that they're going to do. But this parliament, which, as we said, is made of 70% total religious theocrats,
mm-hmm.
okay, very important powers, because what they're going to do, it says the new parliament's primary duty is to appoint the constituent assembly charged with drafting a new constitution to be put to a national referendum later this year.
A constitution that's devoid of Sharia law. And
oh, of course. Yeah. There's not going to be any religion in the constitution at all with this group, right? So we've got the Muslim Brotherhood has 43.7% of a parliament, and then we have the Salafi, which is very, very conservative, and they're going to be very religious and theocratic in their ideas too. That's another 21.7%. They are in charge of appointing this committee that's going to form the constitution for Egypt. So there is some time. They're going to have the constitution, and then they're going to put it to a national referendum later this year. But anyone who's listening in Egypt, you might want to get out.
Yeah, get the hell out.
Before then, that's kind of what I think I would do. The article then goes on to describe they have a complex method of voting for their parliament in here. But it's sufficiently popular to tell you that when they put this constitution up for a national referendum, and if it's a very theocratic constitution, I would predict it's going to pass.
No, of course. And right now they're going under the pretext that America still is somewhat powerful, so they have to pretend that they're going through this whole process. It's already rigged.
Yeah.
They're going to win. You know, this has been their dream, their collective dream for, again, almost 100 years, if not longer.
There's some poll results that are being spread here in our chat room. The Egyptians want all sorts of things.
80% agree on death for apostasy laws, which is totally in sync with Islam.
Yeah, death Muhammad, for apostasy
Muhammad,
laws.
Muhammad, if you leave your religion, mm-hmm. kill. Whoever leaves the religion, kill them.
60% wanted full implementation of Sharia law in mm-hmm. one of the polls.
A library was burned, and that's what Islam did, you know, when it first sacked Egypt. The Alexandria library, they wiped it out, and they said, what more books do we need than the Quran? So this is
Aristotle, lots of Aristotle's writings lost for a long time, and some of them lost permanently, right. No doubt. It says a lot of Egyptian artifacts and ancient texts were destroyed during the revolution, and there is talk about destroying the pyramids. I've heard that as well. So over and over. Now, I have a question from Joe in the chat room. He says, what should the U.S. do about this election outcome?
I mean, this is what Obama wanted. You know what I mean? This is, he allowed it to happen. Doesn't matter what he, I mean, this is, he didn't do anything. He allowed things to go to hell. He wanted Mubarak out. Remember that? He was talking tough against Mubarak. And now he got worse. He got more barbaric leaders in there.
You know, I do think it was only a matter of time before Mubarak was out, based on the election results that you see here. He had very, very little popular support among the people.
Of course.
And
but we kept him in check.
Somehow we did keep
paid
him
off
in check, and
I guess he used
basically force and military power to
keep everybody
in control.
I think about those countries. I mean, if you can keep these guys in check, they won't bother us. It's over now. You know, it's over. They're going to try to, who knows what they're going to do.
But, you know, still.
Mubarak wanted to live, you know, in his mansions, and that's it. That's all he wanted. He didn't give a damn for Islam in that sense. He pretended he was a Muslim and all, yeah.
Right. But, I mean, that is sustainable only so long.
Of course.
Until the will of the people is kicked out. And one of the things, you know, I like to bring up a little bit of John Lewis every week. And this week I watched his panel presentation from ARI's 9/11 anniversary event. And that title was The Islamist Threat. And then there was a subtitle that involved
talking about the Danish
cartoon publisher and other people too. What he talked about there was the indoctrination of children that goes on in these countries, the sort of education,
madrasas,
the sort of summer camp that they go to, where they're given this jihadist training. There were pictures, he had a bunch of slides, and he showed slides of children holding up pictures of martyrs with passages from the Quran on these,
you know,
heroic, saintly-looking pictures.
Well, evil, they know they have to rip the humanity out of these children quick. And they have to.
Yeah. And so if you have a country in which this sort of indoctrination is going on, which I would say in most of the countries in the Middle East, this is going on, and we know that there's more wealth to have a lot more organized education in Saudi Arabia. Uh-huh. And I've heard about textbooks that they have and that they have examples in math that have to do with killing Jews
something. Even in America, in Virginia, in the Saudi textbooks, the American ones, anti-Semitic, calling for, you know, and the politicians like, it's bad. Some of them, when they're exposed to it, but they don't do anything about it.
Yeah. So you don't get surprised when they have their first democratic election and then these people are voted into power.
Yeah, Derek says, or Martin says, based on my knowledge, they're nowhere near the threat. The fact is, they're going to that level. They will ultimately be that kind of threat. The entire Middle East right now is going to Islamic hell, more so than in decades.
Yeah.
I mean, Iran and Saudi Arabia have been our enemies for decades, but now add Egypt to that list very, very soon and add the others because they're going to start fueling their oats.
Yeah, I would say add Egypt to the list later this year after they have a national referendum with their new constitutional government.
The Muslim Brotherhood is sworn to wipe out the West from within. That's their goal. They're the ultimate stealth jihadists. That's their goal.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, you just aren't surprised at all. So in terms of what you would do right now, if you were president, this election just happened in Egypt, I could think of two things.
What do you got?
One would be the giving of a very stern warning. Now, the question is, if we gave a warning right now, would we be believed even with the sort of wars that we've conducted
recently?
We'd have
to show them in action. That was serious by doing something.
So you'd give a warning, and then if they pushed it at all, you'd have to
do
something.
Well, they will
push. But, the first reaction is we wouldn't necessarily go in and invade. One thing I would like to do if I was president right now is I would try to, if you had good intelligence on these things and you could figure out who was the good from the bad, is you would try to allow the good dissidents.
What good? I mean, it's a very small minority.
You'd want to help good people get out.
Yeah, but they're the secular ones. And if Gingrich becomes president, he's against the secular.
Oh, yeah, because secularism is the worst problem in America, right?
My God.
But I'd want some of the secular, you know, Egyptians to be able to come here.
Like they got to get the hell out.
Cynthia Farahat, right?
Of course, they got to get out. They got to go to Europe. They got to come here. You know, these are people who want to live. They don't want to live under Islam. And, you know, likely because of that, they're probably decent people, at least from that
area.
Well,
and there's probably some very decent, very productive people who could be good contributors to our society and who will be completely eaten up.
Some of them are probably going to Israel as well.
Right. You know, go to Israel. Arabs are treated very well in Israel.
They have rights. You know, they don't have the right to kill. It's like,
we have a new person in the chat room who uses bold and blue and says, come on, Iran has a right to have weapons to protect themselves.
Now, I assume he's being sarcastic like Ron Paul, because Ron Paul has said that.
That's true.
He has absolutely said that. He goes, I mean, and you know, and Ron Paul always tries to equate, like, how would we like it if someone comes to their, if someone what? They flew planes to our civilians. They you know, they targeted civilians. What's he talking about? But anyway.
Yeah. And we weren't even talking about Iran right now, too, so I'm not sure. I just kind of dropped in for the chat. So, that I mean, that's what I would do. I wouldn't necessarily go into Egypt at this point in terms of what I would do. I would give a very strong disapproving statement talking about the danger of rule by parties like the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafis.
We're the problem.
That's right. Oh, look, you know, we've actually got somebody who's online who wants to ask a question. Dare we?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's go. Raptor Grant?
I don't know.
Okay.
We'll see.
Hello, you're on.
Hello, this is Stephen Schroyer.
Okay, I can barely hear you. Can you speak up a little bit?
Of course. My name is Stephen Schroyer.
Are you putting on a fake voice?
No.
Can you get him off?
Hello, so...
I have Asperger syndrome.
Turn off. Turn him off.
Turn you off.
Get them off.
Tell me what your topic is.
I was just calling to talk about objectivism.
What about it?
Well, I was thinking about it earlier, and I used to consider myself a libertarian.
Okay.
Like, I used to attend my libertarian gatherings at the college I go to, but I'm on food stamps now, and now I feel like as if I deserve them. Does that mean I'm not a libertarian anymore?
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and answer your question offline here. I mean, it's a question. I think he says he's on entitlement programs and he wants to know whether he deserves them or not.
I'm always suspicious about callers like that. Always.
Okay, well...
I listen to talk radio a lot.
Yeah, here's the thing. Yeah, people here were saying...
might be that person there.
get off the phone, who knows. But... I've had this question before, and I get this question a lot through the Ayn Rand bot, which is the Twitter account that I have that tweets out the Ayn Rand quotes and everything. And some people said, oh, well, because Ayn Rand was against Social Security entitlements as a program, she should not have taken any of the benefits, and so she was a hypocrite, and how dare she, you know.
Out of Rand's entire, they just point that one tiny thing. And first of all, they're wrong,
yeah.
But also it's desperate.
Yeah, but I love it. I love it because, first of all, it's an ad hominem attack. So they just say, oh, well, don't listen to Ayn Rand's arguments at all because, after all, she took Social Security benefits.
That's it.
It could be the case that her arguments were correct, and yet, I mean, it's like the doctor who's smoking who tells you how bad smoking is for you.
Right.
Smoking's still bad for you, whether or not the doctor's sitting there puffing a cigarette, which no one's allowed to do anymore anyway. But... in terms of Rand, her argument was that if you, your parents, your family, you have paid into these programs because the Social Security payroll tax that we have to pay all these years, that you are entitled, so long as you are a staunch opponent of those programs, to go ahead and take the money out of them. Now, in terms of someone who... I think he said he had Asperger's syndrome, you know, I don't know.
I mean.
You know, if you have some sort of a disability such that normally you would be the subject of private charity, and because big government has taken over and basically wiped out private charity, at least private charity is not at the levels that it used to be, then that's another thing where you would say, look, I'm taking it, I'm against it, I fight for... you know, an objectivist or libertarian ideal of society in which government performs only its proper functions, but I will take these benefits at the same time while I fight it. So that's the answer. I don't think that you're necessarily wrong to take the benefits, but if you say that you have a right to the benefits, then you would be wrong to take them, which sounds ironic, but it's true that only those people who continue to fight against the giving of those benefits actually are entitled to it.
Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, are they having a debate here in the chat room? Is that what you're pointing to?
This loudmouth with the big fat letters.
Okay. Oh, so the Israeli regimes are controlling the U.S. government. All sorts of fun stuff we've got going on here. Okay. So before we got off track, I was just finishing up our topic, and our topic again was the Islamic parties dominating the Egyptian parliamentary elections. This has been a big test platform for the Arab Spring, and so the Arab Spring gets a big fat F, a failure, if you're judging this. And I do think it's going to get dangerous in Egypt pretty quick for anybody who's living in Egypt. Any freedom-loving Egyptian, I would try to get out. And yeah, go to Israel. You'll be treated a lot better there. You'll be appreciated more if you are a secular, freedom-loving individual. If you want to go ahead and live under a theocracy, I guess stay there. But, you know, I don't have no authority at all in this country. But if I did have authority in this country, I would issue a condemnation, you know, an official condemnation, use your little bully pulpit. And you would just say a warning, you know, just maybe just float out there that you're just kind of watching to see if they're going to develop the sort of jihadist, you know, platforms and things like that within their constitution. If they, you know, have as a statement in their constitution that they're going to work towards the global caliphate or something, that's going to be a big problem. Pianki says, pardon my font size. Okay, so we have someone in the chat room who's using a larger font size, but it's his vision that's the problem. So now we've got other people using large font size in the chat room in order to make up for it. Yeah, in terms of the Iranian state, this is what they're debating in my chat room right now, whether the Iranian state is a legitimate state. The Iranian state, they describe themselves as the Islamic Republic of Iran. Insofar as they are governed by Islam, I know enough about Islam to know that it is an illegitimate, non-rights respecting ideology, and therefore any regime based on that is not only not respecting the rights of its own citizens, but it has designs on taking over the world as well, which Iran has taken actions, outward actions, consistent with. So I think that's pretty much it in terms of Iran. So I think I've answered that question, and probably some people aren't going to like my answer, so that's fine. What else do we have going on? It's actually 6 o'clock my time right now. So what have we gotten done in the first hour? We've talked about the new groupthink. We have talked about the Islamic elections, and we've talked about the wonderful arms deal between Saudi Arabia and China. We weren't actually talking about Iran, but that got brought in too, as a little bit of a side issue. So in terms of our next hour, what are we going to talk about? The first thing that I wanted to discuss was another New York Times article, believe it or not. There was another good, worth discussing New York Times article. This one dated January 21st, how the U.S. lost out on iPhone work. How the U.S. lost out on iPhone work. Everybody loves their iPhones. Who has iPhones in the chat room? Who loves iPhones? Who has Siri and will make me jealous in the chat room? That's what I want to know.
I mean, we got to get Siri-is.
We got to get Siri-is. I want Siri. I don't know. I'm going to have to spring for it pretty soon, because I have watched the commercials.
And we've seen it in person.
Well, yeah, I played with it in person a little bit. It's hard to play with Siri in an Apple store because the Apple store is so bustling, full of people and conversation, that you have to very deliberately ask Siri your question, otherwise it can't hear you. Some people have Android. Luke says, me, me, me. I've got Joe and Chris both say that they have the iPhone. Robert says he has the iPhone but no Siri. And then he says, Nuance is a good stock? Is Nuance the technology behind Siri? Is that why he said that? Maybe. Siri is great at sometimes, but it still needs work. I'm sure Siri does still need work. And what you're getting right now, I think if you get Siri, is you're going to get some usefulness and utility.
I'd like to ask it, what does Islam mean? Ask Siri.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, Luke, you could do that little experiment for us right now. Ask, have Siri tell us what Islam means.
Hmm.
probably it's just going to give a Wikipedia something, or who knows, it's going to Google it. So I think it's time to see what I can do, if I can. I'm wondering what I can do with Pianchi, if I'm able to kick him out of the chat room or something. You know, I've never had to kick anybody out of the chat room before. It's kind of interesting. And
I just try and dominate with that bold.
I don't know how to do it.
That's fine.
Oh, here we go. How do we do it?
That word kick, I like.
You like that one? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like that word.
Does that work?
Probably.
Okay. Well, we'll see if that worked. We tried to help you there in the chat room, people. So I'm not usually having to moderate like that, but sometimes.
You're into censorship.
That's right. I'm censoring.
That's it. It's like,
oh, my God.
The Saudi accused me. He goes, I'm a censor.
If you don't let people publish whatever they want on your blog, that is censorship. You know it's
especially
true.
If they say you bleeping, bleep, bleep, bleep.
Yeah. So in terms of Siri, I have to have it. Why? Because I am such a technology geek that I'm embarrassed to say, should I tell them?
What?
I get emotionally involved in a Siri commercial.
Yes.
I'm so impressed with this technology and the potential for it. It's not like I think it's at its potential now, but when you think of the fact that what you used to watch
in Star Wars
and other science fiction movies, that it comes true.
Amy is the kind of customer, the kind of reader anyone would want to have. She gets totally, I don't know, and completely involved with things like that. Whether it's a great commercial, whether it's a movie, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, they have Siri commercials that sort of tug on your heartstrings.
They're beautiful,
a little
yeah.
bit, and I get wrapped up in it. So I definitely need to do it as soon as possible. I have played with one in the store.
Tonight, let's go.
Yeah, I think they're going to be closed
after
by the time
the show,
we're done
go.
With. Yeah, I don't think they're going to sell it to us. And you do. You want that instant gratification of going in the store and walking out with
Absolutely.
It that day, as opposed to ordering it online and waiting for it to come. So funny. So let's talk about why the U.S. lost out on iPhone work. And this is a longer article. It's composed of interviews, confidential interviews, that New York Times reporters did with executives and other people who worked for Apple. I gather that these people were not supposed to discuss things with the New York Times because Apple has such a you know, confidentiality policy. So that's got interesting issues in and of itself. You don't know how you feel about this. But in terms of why Apple does not manufacture its iPhones here, we would all think, well,
right.
it's just because of the cost, right? They get to pay lower wages overseas, or it's just because of, you know, certain particular regulations. But this article makes it clear that the work, the kind of the work ethic
right.
of the workers overseas, the workforce overseas
right.
is more diligent, more flexible, more responsive,
more effective.
That they are able to, get a whole factory going, manufacturing something very quickly.
Right.
So the ramp up time for making a change in a product or developing a new product is so much shorter in these Chinese factories in particular that they're describing overseas. It is amazing. So, you know, they start out talking about that dinner. Everyone heard about the dinner that Steve Jobs had with President Obama. Apparently, President Obama interrupted Steve Jobs when Steve Jobs was speaking at this dinner, and he said, "What would it take to make iPhones in the United States?" And years ago, Apple used to boast that its products were made in America, but today few of Apple's products are made in America. It says, Mr. Jobs' reply was unambiguous. Those jobs aren't coming back, he said, according to another dinner guest. And then the article says that the president's question touched upon a central conviction at Apple. It isn't just that workers are cheaper abroad. Rather, Apple's executives believe the vast scale of overseas factories, as well as the flexibility, diligence, and industrial skills of foreign workers, have so outpaced their American counterparts that made in the USA is no longer a viable option for most Apple products. Now, I'm going to give you little bits and highlights of this article. This is quite a long article. The one thing that I didn't, you know, make a marking on or highlight, but that it's pervasive throughout. are the questions that the reporters ask about what the responsibility of Apple should be with regard to creating jobs here in the United States versus sending them over to China. Or should Apple feel guilty when there's so many jobs in China and yet its executives here are paid so much money and there's no good middle class jobs for people here in the United States? So this, you know, the altruist sort of theme does exist throughout this. Apple executives, I'm skipping down in the article, Apple executives say that going overseas at this point is their only option. One former executive described how the company relied upon a Chinese factory to revamp iPhone manufacturing just weeks before the device was due on shelves. Apple had redesigned the iPhone screen at the last minute, forcing an assembly line overhaul. New screens began arriving at the plant near midnight. A foreman immediately roused 8,000 workers inside the company's dormitories, according to the executive. Each employee was given a biscuit and a cup of tea, guided to a workstation, and within half an hour started a 12-hour shift fitting glass screens to beveled frames. Within 96 hours, the plant was producing over 10,000 iPhones a day. So talk about that sort of flexibility and ramp-up that they're willing
to do. Be ready for anything.
And imagine doing that to union workers here in the United States and the kind of griping and complaining that you would get.
Well, you know, the ones who love unions that don't love work, they hate work.
Yeah. Now, in terms of, you know, looking at jobs overseas versus jobs here, we've got a discussion going on. What is this? Oh, we have another. Boy, we're having fun. Okay. Oh, let me do this again.
Keep going.
Yeah. Okay. I'm continuing on. We're having fun in the chat room today, apparently.
Some punks are popping up.
So, in terms of this focus on jobs, right, and we've seen this kind of out of context focus on jobs. Everyone is so concerned with jobs that they are concerned about it in irrational places. And the Apple executives are calling people on this as well. It says, privately, the Apple executives say that the world is now such a changed place that it is a mistake to measure a company's contribution simply by tallying its employees, though they note that Apple employs more workers in the United States now than ever before. That's an end quote there. So they're, you know, in a sense, they do want to defend themselves and say, look, we create jobs, you know, in the United States now here more than we did before, but nonetheless, you shouldn't judge us according to this. And it's true. No individual enterprise should be judged based on just the jobs that it creates. If Apple creates wealth, and that wealth is enjoyed, that increase in productivity, that just the increase in enjoyment of life is experienced by people here in the United States, that is going to have so-called trickle down, across, up, whatever effects to create jobs places. So this idea of just measuring exactly how many jobs Apple has here, it's the same thing that they've been doing to Romney with Bain Capital, which is ridiculous. And I think it's unacceptable that Romney can't defend himself on that score. At least here, Apple executives are explicitly rejecting this idea that you can measure a company's contribution by tallying its employees.
And then Romney, the city on the shining hill, it's like, that's Reagan's line.
Well, and the funny thing is the first person in this election cycle to talk about the shining city on the hill was, of course, Herman Cain.
Yeah, he botched it, though.
And I guess Romney waited a long enough time after.
I mean,
but anyway, let's go back.
So stupid.
Let's go back to the pleasant Apple discussion. So the other thing that the executives said, these Apple executives, is that curing unemployment is not Apple's job.
Excellent.
Which
excellent.
I love. It says, and here's a quote from one executive. It's a current Apple executive. We sell iPhones in over 100 countries, a current Apple executive said. We don't have an obligation to solve America's problems. Our only obligation is making the best product possible.
Excellent.
End quote. So if you work for Apple and there is a role at Apple for a philosopher lawyer like me to help you, I have technological experience and I love your products, come find me, because I love when I hear stuff like that from Apple
excellent.
People.
It's absolutely true.
Just make great products and forget the rest of it. And that was Steve Jobs.
And Obama,
focus.
You know, what can we do? Say, what can you do? Get the hell out of our way. That's it.
Yeah. In terms of the components of iPhones, I found it was interesting to learn about this. All iPhones contain hundreds of parts, an estimated 90% of which are manufactured abroad. Advanced semiconductors have come from Germany and Taiwan, memory from Korea and Japan, display panels and circuitry from Korea and Taiwan, chipsets from Europe, and rare metals from Africa and Asia. And all of it is put together in China.
And, you know, Apple here is saying, look, this is the way it is. We just get a better product that way. And people don't want to hear that. They want to, yeah, but we've got jobs back here. Well, a company like Apple is the biggest company on the earth, isn't it? Isn't the most successful company?
Well, and it's also...
And they have said, well, this is just the way it is.
It's also the most innovative and quickly innovative.
Absolutely.
So when you read the Jobs biography and he talks about having a brainstorm idea when the product is due out in a week or something, who's going to have the flexibility to incorporate that at the last minute?
Right.
Only the Chinese factory is what they're saying.
They should invite some executives and say, can you take over the government for just about a year just to see what you could do? I'm joking.
Well, and here's, I mean, there's obviously some fallacies in that. And Mitt Romney talks about the fact that he's a businessman
exactly.
And he's going
to
treat government like
a
business. And then he talks about
allocating
assets.
But let's just say, anything,
let's
say
this is not
anything
right.
else would be an improvement. That's the point.
True. This shift to basically overseas production of a lot of Apple products occurred in 2004 when Tim Cook, who replaced Jobs as chief executive, moved overseas. And it says, for Mr. Cook, the focus on Asia came down to two things, said one former high-ranking Apple executive. Factories in Asia, quote, can scale up and down faster, end quote. And also, again, a new quote, Asian supply chains have surpassed what's in the U.S. The result is that we can't compete at this point, the executive said.
And we don't want to hear that. That's why we all say, we want more, you know, bring the jobs back here. Well, Apple has understood firsthand.
There was one concrete example given in the article, which I had to highlight because I just thought this is unheard of. There was a Chinese plant, a Chinese factory company, that was trying to get a contract from Apple. The Apple team visited the factory in China, and the plant's owners were already constructing a new wing, and they were constructing it in case Apple gave them the contract.
Unbelievable.
You would never have that here.
No.
First, they'd have to have the contract. Then they'd have to go through all the building permits.
That right
there
might make the difference. When they see that room, it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
These guys are deadly serious.
Very, very serious. So the entire supply chain, they say, is in China now, another high-ranking
Incredible.
Apple executive said. You need 1,000 rubber gaskets? That's the factory next door. You need 1 million screws? That factory is a block away. You need that screw made a little bit different? It'll take 3 hours. And this is the kind of responsiveness that they're getting overseas.
Yeah.
It says they could, I'm skipping down again, they could hire 3,000 people overnight, said Jennifer Rigoni, who was Apple's worldwide supply demand manager until 2010, but declined to discuss specifics of her work. She says, what U.S. plant can find 3,000 people overnight and convince them to live in dorms? Because that's
yes.
what they do. They live in dorms.
And those who bitch about it say, well, if they were able to find them, of course they would rather have it here. It's closer. It's more control.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would be much easier for them to have it here. And then
Apple
executives could go visit anytime that they wanted. It would be much nicer. Some aspects of the iPhone, they say, are uniquely American. The device's software, for instance, and its innovative marketing campaigns were largely created in the United States. Apple recently built a $500 million data center in North Carolina. Crucial semiconductors inside the iPhone 4 and 4S are manufactured in Austin, Texas, by Samsung. But, you know, in general, these companies, Apple and other companies, are finding that they have to go overseas to get the kind of things that they want. Corning, and I believe it's Corning who makes the Gorilla Glass is the unscratchable, awesome glass that's on the iPhone.
When Jobs saw that, he said, okay, that's it.
Yeah, it says, much of the glass in the iPhones is still made in Corning's factory in Kentucky. However, the bulk of Corning's strength in glass manufacturing is occurring in Japan and Taiwan because they, too, have found that they've got to have it over there. It says, our customers are in Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and China, said Corning's vice chairman and chief financial officer. We could make the glass here and then ship it by boat, but that takes 35 days. Or we could ship it by air, but that's 10 times as expensive. So we build our glass factories next door to assembly factories, and those are overseas. And this is why middle-class jobs, as the article goes on to say, are leaving.
Right.
Because these are skilled engineering jobs, and they describe the jobs as jobs that take more than a high school education, but less than a full college degree. And
they get the job done.
Yeah. So now they say, for Americans without college degrees now, today's new jobs are mostly in service occupations, and you could be either at a restaurant or a call center or a hospital attendant or a temporary worker, and there's fewer opportunities for reaching the middle class with these sorts of jobs because, you know, again, the cost effectiveness, the flexibility, the ability to ramp up production quickly and stuff, and the training is all overseas. Then the article has this whole thing about the headline is paydays for Apple, and they say, oh, Apple should feel guilty for the middle class jobs going away because all these stock grants. Yeah, New York Times.
Okay.
So obviously you get
the editorial pops in.
Yeah, you get some of the traditional stuff. But there is a current executive at Apple who defended themselves. They said, we shouldn't be criticized for using Chinese workers. The U.S. has stopped producing people with the skills
Absolutely.
We need.
And they are here to make money. They're here to make products. They're here to have a great business.
Yeah. And what's more, Apple sources say that the company has created plenty of good American jobs inside its retail stores and among entrepreneurs who are selling iPhone and iPad applications. Mm. That's true as well. Then they go back to the conversation of the dinner with Jobs and Obama. It says, Mr. Jobs told Obama, he says, you don't have to worry about the country's long-term future. He says, this country is insanely great. So he used his catchphrase.
But he never used it lightly.
No. I mean, I'm sure he meant it. This country is insanely great. Particularly, he loved the Silicon Valley area and the confluence of all the different
influences. That's great to hear.
That made him be able to do what he did.
This country is insanely great.
He says, what I'm worried about is that we don't talk enough about solutions. And then there were different solutions thrown around by the executives at this dinner. Some of them have suggested that the government should reform visa programs to help companies hire foreign engineers. Yes, we should have a lot more open immigration. So some had urged the president to give companies a tax holiday so that they could bring back from overseas profits, which they argued would be used to create work. And then here's Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was not consistent in terms of his good philosophy. It says, Jobs even suggested that it might be possible someday to locate some of Apple's skilled manufacturing in the United States if the government helped train more American engineers.
Yeah.
It's not the government that needs to train these engineers.
No, they would make terrible engineers if they did.
Yeah. Joe here says, I was born in Austin. I've lived in Austin for a year. Austin's a cool town. I'm glad that Apple is manufacturing some stuff there. That's excellent. And I would like to see more of it here. And I would say that we would train more of these engineers here if our economy wasn't so sluggish, I think of our economy like molasses, that you're not able to flow money and resources.
And Obama wouldn't have it any other way.
Expertise is not able to flow into the areas that it's needed quickly because of all the, the interference from government.
And government has the power to keep it the way it is.
Yeah. And the pace of innovation at Apple, they say it has been quick. I mean, it's an example of some of the quickest pace of innovation ever. It says GM used to go as long as half a decade between major automobile redesigns. Apple, by comparison, has released 5 iPhones in 4 years, doubling the device's speed and memory while dropping the price that some consumers pay.
And one thing also, you know, people have to get that new iPhone. They can't wait till, well, I'll get the, you know, the one two down. No.
Well, it's those
they might,
wonderful commercials.
They might wait,
when
though,
you see those commercials.
For the one like 4S. They might wait for that one. You may not know.
Right.
But it's just incredible. You got to have it. That's the whole feeling, you know.
I hear the iPad 3 is maybe going to come out soon, and I don't know what the iPad 3 offers that the iPad 2 doesn't offer.
Someone said something about the smaller screen, which I'm not crazy about the idea. I love the screen as it is, to read, to watch movies, Netflix, and this and that, so I don't know.
Yeah, we haven't even seen
it. It might give it optional.
So I might jump from 1 to 3. We'll have to see how it is.
Yeah.
Now, Martin says, I don't know what the writer intended with it, but it's an excellent introduction to how markets work. I'm not sure if he's talking about this article or something else.
Probably. You know, New York Times, they will, you know, they will get to places that other papers can't. So they will have stories like this. And then, of course, they got to shoehorn in their leftist agenda. But overall, it's a valuable piece.
Now, Rolf might be saying, watch GM's quality start to drop since they don't have to worry about shareholders. It says what? Maybe that's an autocorrect spelling. I agree that you're going to see that they're going to do that. Yeah, rumors is that Apple's working on TV. I would love if Apple would work on a TV solution that would replace our cable, or at least provide some competition to cable. Right. That would be excellent. Yeah, there should be the ability to get these engineering jobs here in the United States and to be able to have entrepreneurs. Imagine here in the United States building a whole new wing of your factory just in case you get a contract. Because even you think that things are going well and business is so good that even if you don't get that particular contract, there's going to be another one waiting in the wings that you'll be ready to go. Okay, so Martin says that the book that we need to look at is iPencil by Leonard E. Reed. And I'm wondering if Leonard Reed is the same one who was the
Jobs,
FEE?
I think possibly, because he was influenced by something that they wrote, a book of his. No, yes or no?
Oh, Jobs was influenced by this?
Okay. I might be totally wrong, but the name sounds familiar.
Martin says we're digressing. Well, you know, anything that gets some education for people about how markets actually work in the real world, it would be good. So, I mean, I guess I'm not surprised at all by what I learned in here, but I thought that...
It's an article. Okay.
I thought that it would just be merely about the cost. And they said, and I forget exactly where it is here in the article, because, again, this is a 11-page piece, but it said that it costs, I think, $65 more to manufacture the iPhone. So the difference, it's not the difference is so much. Well, no,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, but if you accumulate it, I mean.
Well, right. But they're saying that the issue is not primarily the cost.
The issue is the workers.
Yeah, it's the workers and the flexibility.
And getting a job, you
literally cannot get the same work at the same time.
And you want these out at a certain time. You want them. You don't want people to wait for them.
No. You want to be able to get it done as soon as possible. I can go ahead and try to find that. Tell me if there's any more good comments there in the chat room, Bosch, while I find this one statistic about the cost.
Also singing.
You're going to sing?
I can sing, but no one ever heard me except me.
No one heard you sing except
you?
Well,
a few people.
Yeah, I guess you weren't singing when you said, we're the problem, right? No, that was...
We're the problem. That's basically, that's Ron Paul from this skit, this parody that Rush had on his shows. It was great. Check it out if you haven't heard and seen it. Just put Rush parody of Ron Paul. I forgot the guy's name, the comedian. He does a great job.
And, you know, Ron Paul didn't even get to do that this week because in the debate, they didn't even talk about foreign policy.
So he didn't shoehorn it in at the end, just say, we need to be friends with our enemies.
Well, he did. He mentioned the problem with the endless wars. He did mention that as a little aside here and there.
Right.
He even got into the immigration question, I remember. He put a little thing about... We need more resources in order to protect our borders at home, and we could have them if we just took all of our outposts overseas and brought them back home and all that good stuff. excellent people have the link there that we can go ahead and read. Chris says, bring out Angry Bosch. We can bring out Angry Bosch probably after we start talking politics again. We have talked about, well, we talked some about what's going on in the Middle East, but we haven't talked about our disappointing politicians until now. This is our officially titled Hope is Just a Little Bit Better Than Despair segment. This is actually what I had intended my politics segments to be called, and then I even gave up on hope.
Right.
Okay? So hope is just a little bit better than despair. It's a phrase to say, look, hope and despair are just emotions. Hope is a little bit better because it's positive, but really that's all you have is hope.
And
that's all we have right now. In terms of our candidates for 2012, the best you can have is hope, and the more I'm exposed to our range of candidates right now, I lose even hope.
Do that one line that you had this week. You tweeted something really good.
Which one?
About petals.
Oh, yeah. So the one tweet that I put out this week that was quite popular, if everybody remembers that game that people used to play with flowers, and what kind of flowers were they? Daffodils?
I don't know.
Sunflowers, some kind of flower, like a sunflower that's got a lot of petals. But I'm thinking of the flowers that have the yellow centers and the white petals.
Good.
Daisies?
Maybe.
So you're supposed to, you know, when you're a young girl and you're really silly about boys and there's some boy that you like, but heaven forbid you actually show the boy that you like him or that you'll maybe have, you know, some way to find out whether the guy actually likes you. Instead, you're just going to sit there and daydream and decide whether he likes you by taking the petals off of a flower. And so you pick the one petal off and it was, he loves me. Next petal, you pull it, he loves me not. Then you pull off the next petal, he loves me. Then you pull off the next petal, he loves me not. And you just keep doing that until you run out of petals. And then whichever thing that you've said when you pick off the last petal, that's the thing that's true. Either he loves you or he doesn't love you. So I felt this week in terms of Gingrich versus Romney, you could just play the same game and you could say, Gingrich is worse. No, Romney is worse. No, Gingrich is worse. No, Romney is worse. And then you could figure out which one is worse, probably by figuring out which flower petal is left. And I would look at my news feed on Facebook this week, and someone would post something horrible about Gingrich, and somebody else would post something horrible about Romney. And they'd both be true.
Yeah.
They'd both be true.
That's the problem.
Azua says, are you required to eat the flower petals? You could eat the flower petals, I assume. You know, some people like to eat flower petals as part of a balanced diet and also as part of beautiful cuisine. If you are the Iron Chef sort of cook, they put on your salads.
Okay.
Very nice restaurants, very pretty edible flower petals. And my grandmother did tell me, so since we're in the hope is just a little bit better than despair segment, and since I learned that sentence from my grandmother told me stories that I used to eat her flowers.
That's funny.
Yes, when I was a kid. So she'd say there'd be some flower in her yard, and she had spent a long time trying to get it to finally bloom, and she was so happy it finally bloomed, and I'd come over and visit, and I'd eat the flower.
That's funny.
So I grew up okay. I think I'm fine. Some people think I'm crazy maybe, so maybe it made me a little crazy, but I think I turned out fine. In terms of the debate this week, I don't know if you watched it, but John King started out with the worst question that you could start out with at a presidential debate, and Gingrich really let him have it because King asked him about Gingrich's ex-wife expose tell-all interview for ABC. I guess the question was whether Gingrich really did ask his wife to have an open marriage.
I think the question was the point of, you know, that's it.
Yeah. Whether Gingrich had the open marriage and if the fact that he did should be relevant to whether we want him as president.
Yeah.
I'm in the rebellious stage where, I mean, first of all, I don't think an open marriage is that great an idea personally.
No.
But if it was true, I almost would like Gingrich more because you'd say, okay, well, here's a candidate that cannot consistently be for social issues. Although I don't know, because if he becomes then born again, he might even be more social issues pushing than the typical candidate. But I agree with Gingrich that this was a completely inappropriate question to start with. And if you watched it, he said that that he said it was despicable. I think he used the word despicable.
No, he goes, he says, I am close to despicable. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Just call it despicable if you want. I mean, you know what I mean? He always has to add words.
Modifiers.
Yeah,
lots of modifiers.
Fundamental.
He did not read Strunk and White's Elements
no,
of
didn't.
Style. He did not.
Oh, no, he read it and is defying it.
I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, he says, I'm appalled that you would start
you know
out
what?
A presidential
it's just,
debate.
It's so sick. I mean, you know, you are forced to say, you know, well, I like him better at this moment. You know what I mean? A guy that you don't like at all. But it's, well, at this moment, he's better than the other guy. The other guy stinks right now. And the only thing Romney had going for him last week is the fact that these guys idiotically went after him for his venture capitalist job. And you know, people took it as an attack on capitalism, which it absolutely was. And that's good. But people weren't defending Romney, per se. I mean, Romney can't defend Romney. You know?
No, I mean, we just, it's the flavor of the week because of the attack of the week. And
that's it.
That's about where we're at. So, you know, Gingrich, of course, lets King have it. And I thought it was funny because after the debate was over, they have the immediate interviews of the candidate one-on-one
mm-hmm.
with the moderator. So it's John King sitting there asking Gingrich this question, and he asked Gingrich, he says, oh, how do you think that the debate went? And Gingrich doesn't bring up this, you know, starting question of the debate at all. He's sitting there face to face with
King.
He
doesn't have to, but at the same time, it seems like a disconnect.
Well, and it was funny because he says, oh, you know, I think we did well, and we discussed this, you know, some kind of platitude statement. And then he said, I think John did a good job.
He didn't have to say that.
Well, first of all,
you know,
he didn't have to say it. And he said it in the third person to John himself. So I'm thinking that Gingrich was probably having a hard time keeping it together. And I would understand.
I think he was drunk off of the applause. I think he was drunk.
Yeah.
I think it was.
Maybe.
He got more standing ovations than anyone so far. He got two at least.
Yeah. Now, Romney took the high road in terms of talking about Gingrich's ex-wife and their open marriage.
Well, Romney will let his people do the dirty work with their commercials and whatnot. So anyway.
Yeah, yeah. He'll take the high road and let them do that. Santorum, being the so-called self-portrayed good Boy Scout that he is, these are issues of character for people to consider. And then Ron Paul sounded like he was taking the high road, but he made sure he mentioned his 54-year marriage in the process. In terms of Gingrich, he was bringing up the fact that we want to allow natural gas exploration, but he was quick to bring in that there were all sorts of good things you could do with the royalties that would come from it. So he has in mind, oh yeah, we're going to have government allow people to develop natural gas, but then we're going to grab some substantial portion of the royalties. So don't buy him as, you know, being small government. Romney, he was getting some applause, and there were people on my Twitter feed that were, I mean, you know, when you tweet out really fast, they were tweeting out a bravo because he says, there's nothing wrong with profit, by the way. And there's one woman on my Twitter feed who was like, oh, great, he's defending profit. But she sent the tweet too fast because in the very next breath, he said, oh, and by the way, the profits are going towards pensions and charity.
So therefore, that makes it okay. Yeah.
Yeah, profits are good because they go to pensions and charities.
He stinks.
Yeah, he also said that capitalism and freedom make America strong, you know. He's talking a good game, but if you actually listen to what he says, A, he's got a ton of altruism in him, and B, he has plans that are total antithesis of capitalism
Absolutely.
And freedom. Santorum, he wants a capitalism that works for everyone.
He was speaking Obama style. He really was. Where everyone gets an opportunity. It's like,
yeah, he sounds more like Obama than any of the other candidates.
Yeah, he really does.
It's funny because Romney
is a social conservative, period. But when it comes to government, he's a big government hack.
Yeah, Romney is very much like Obama, but Romney doesn't sound as much like Obama as Santorum does.
No, he doesn't.
And Santorum used to make me think that he was less like Obama, but now he's sounding so
Absolutely.
Much like Obama that I have to take him at his word and
no
think that he's going to be Obama plus social issues.
Yes, exactly.
Which
right.
is worse than Obama.
Absolutely right.
So
in that sense,
it's just terrible. Ron Paul talks about the fact that he gets so many donations from the military.
Right, right. That's right.
Flip
now,
that
look,
in there.
You know, again, might be military members who are sick and tired of us not waging war for the last 10 years. And they're like, you know what, we want to stop this non-war wars going on. So who knows? That might be
the
issue.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think that today's military has real, palpable grievances. But the answer is not Ron Paul's theory.
No.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. One second. I have to quote something. It's Mark Stein today about Romney. And basically, his whole thing is the man who gave us Newt. And he's blaming Mitt Romney.
Okay.
Because he's so terrible in defending himself. And this is a quote from one of his speeches. I find it hard to believe, but this is what
this
he quotes.
This is a quote from Romney?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe in an America where millions of Americans believe in an America that's the America millions of Americans believe in. That's the America I love.
Oh, my
now,
God.
I've had to find out if that's true because you want me to do it again?
Yeah,
please,
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
This is a real quote.
This is, I mean, Mark Stein, I don't, you know.
Yeah, I think he's good.
Yeah, he goes, no, he's excellent. But
yeah.
He goes, I believe in an America where millions of Americans believe in an America that's the America millions of Americans believe in. That's the America I love. Now, Mark Stein said, Mitt paid some guy to write this insipid pep, and he paid others to approve it. Not only is it bland and generic, it's lethal to him in a way that it wouldn't be to Gingrich or Perry or Bachman or Paul because it plays to his caricature as a synthetic, stage-managed, hollow man of no fixed beliefs.
Yep.
That's hilarious.
I believe it. Ugh, it's just horrible. Romney, you know, they had this question that was going around about whether veterans were entitled to certain sorts of benefits or help. And I personally believe that it's a proper role of government to give various benefits to veterans, obviously, because they're performing a service for us. So if you said, okay, well, we're going to do a little bit of transition job training or something, okay, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing to provide them as part of a benefit package for their military service. Romney talks about put the veterans job training at the state level. There's so many things that he wants to block grant to the states.
Yep.
Mark my words, if he becomes president, I have no idea who's going to become president, but if he does, mark my words that he will use the fact that he's block granting things to the state level to manufacture accounting numbers for his budget and make it look balanced when
Absolutely.
It's not. Who knows? He might have done similar things. I'd like to look at his Massachusetts
Absolutely.
Budget and see if he block granted things to the
right.
counties or the
right.
cities or whatever. That would be pretty funny. And the worst thing that Romney did was talk about repealing and replacing. He has in mind replacing Obamacare with something else. Lord knows what
right.
it is.
Right.
One person in my Twitter feed was joking. He says, yeah, you know, Obamacare is 2,700 pages. My legislation won't be more than 2,400. That's what, you know, Romney's going to be proud of, that he's going to have a 2,400-page piece of legislation.
Right.
What I do know is that he did use the word mandate in connection with insurance companies. And if you put any mandates on insurance companies or any more mandates on insurance companies, because they have plenty on them already, if you do that, you're just going to push them out of business. And as we talked about, you know, there's various time bombs in Obamacare that put mandates on insurance companies. The more you put on them, the quicker they're going to go out of business, the quicker you're pushed into a single-payer system. So, you know, Gingrich, in his disconnected from reality academic way, when they went on and asked him what he thought of what Romney said, he says, oh, none of what he said sounds bad to me. So he's on board with the replace Obamacare with something hideous as well.
But also one thing, Ron Paul is not adamant about repealing.
This is the thing. Okay,
you would think he would be, at least.
I thought Ron Paul was actually incoherent discussing the Obamacare question
this
week.
When isn't he incoherent?
I mean, I had a hard time because you would think that Ron Paul, above anybody,
Absolutely.
Would be for a total repeal
At least,
of Obamacare.
And be passionate with conviction.
I mean,
about it, but no.
He's the one where you've got the commercials and they're smashing huge departments, cabinet level departments. Department of Education gone, you know? And he said, well, theoretically, we could have a total repeal of Obamacare, but it's not very likely, or some odd stuff like that. And I'm thinking,
he's resigned to it.
It hasn't even gone into effect fully yet.
He won't even speak
and
against
Ron
it.
And Ron Paul, who's the champion of scaling back big government, is not for a total repeal, and he's not confident about
it's
a total repeal of Obamacare.
It's revelatory. It's a revelation because you look at it and say, wait a minute, what the hell, Ron Paul of all?
Well, and then he goes on. He says, well, the real problem is government involvement in medicine as such, and then he gives a theoretical dissertation.
So then,
and I'm just telling you, you know, he says a lot of things in at a theory level, which always sound good. You know, he recognizes that government involves force, and you know, he often
it's disconnected.
Says
again, he's also a thing.
It's totally disconnected.
It's like,
because,
wait a minute.
You know, again, I've said this many times. I mean, I'm not a political expert, but to me, it seems if you were putting together a transition plan from where we are now to getting to a government that performs only its proper functions of protecting individual rights, if you were doing that, a way to do it with causing the least harm, the least damage possible would be to have a last-in, first-out approach.
Right.
That you would repeal those regulations and legislation
that
were
sense.
Most recently enacted first. So Obamacare should be the big...
first thing out.
You know, Dodd-Frank is another one that they throw out as, you know, having been recently enacted and still fresh in people's minds.
And it happened to be the worst also.
Just go backwards in the Federal Register.
The most recent regulations seem to be the worst also, Dodd-Frank, Obamacare. I mean,
well, and they have to get worse.
They're bigger and uglier and nastier than the earlier ones.
They so have to get
worse, knock out the big,
yeah.
ugly monsters first and then knock out the other rats.
Yeah, I bet that would be an interesting study to do as
it
well.
Would be.
To see how much longer and more intricate legislation has to get the later in time that it's passed, whenever you're
and
dealing with a certain
government
area.
Will never stop it. They have to be stopped, ultimately.
Anyway, so Ron Paul didn't make any sense to
no,
me.
No, he didn't.
It's like, wouldn't you expect, I mean, that is the one of the things that you would think if you elected Ron Paul, yeah, we'd get blown up by a nuclear weapon, but at least we wouldn't have Obamacare, right?
But no.
But no.
He never even says the name, does he? He's some different...
He hardly ever
no.
uses the word.
No, he doesn't.
It's really strange,
and I
don't get
it. I think he
might
like it. I think he might like it. Who knows? If he's not passionately against it, it's like, wait a minute, he's for it?
Michael says it goes to show that the philosophy-less libertarians have no clue that capitalism must be a total separation of state and economy.
And, you know, Ron Paul, so I think I did hear him giggle in the debate, which is why I had to make a cartoon this week called The Giggler, like the Riddler. And check it out when you can.
What I love, though, is that somebody tweeted back to you and said
that's not
calling
funny.
Him a giggler isn't even funny.
That's, of course, a Ron Paul fan. And it made people get...
No, I thought he was saying it was so obvious that it wasn't even funny.
No,
that wasn't the point?
No, he was a Ron Paul fan. Of course he doesn't like it.
So in terms of the GOP candidates, I want to just tell them, look, I want a total repeal. No replacement that shouldn't be replaced with anything.
And
here's the thing, you know, I
should be shut down and say, wait a minute.
I keep having to come back with questions that I would like to pose to the candidate to try to back them into a corner. And I thought, well, maybe you have to ask them this. Would you have voted for Obamacare if you were in the Congress at the time?
Right.
Or would you have signed it? And then if they say no, then you say, okay, well, why won't you just repeal it entirely?
And why wouldn't you have signed it? Why wouldn't you have signed it?
Yeah.
And then what are you going to do to repeal it?
Yeah. And
you can't speak that late. You can't have it both. I mean, Romney is pulling in Obama. I will repeal it and then da-da-da and replace it. And, you know, it's no. If we don't repeal it, we're done.
Yeah.
And
then,
Obama knows that. That's why he enacted it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's getting its tentacles into everybody all quickly now. So anyway,
well, it's a dangerous creature that we have to kill now.
Now it shows, here's the thing, Santorum. Do you need more evidence that Santorum is truly awful?
No.
I have another piece that shows Santorum to be even worse. I found him so annoying at this debate, and I was glad. He got smacked down pretty hard in the South Carolina primary, right?
He's always bitchy, too. If you see him, he's always like fighting against something. He's always annoyed. It's really ugly for a candidate. I mean, really, he's always like sneering. He's like fighting something somehow, some way. He's fighting the perception of what people think of him. Well, look at you. Anyway.
He used to be better, I thought, and then after Iowa,
after he won,
he got more full of himself, and then he started.
Because now he's like, wait a minute, I might be president.
So
I can bring families together.
Yeah, listen to this. You know, he was rattling on about the manufacturing, and it was funny because John King brought up Apple.
Did he? Okay.
And I was, yay, I get to hear about Apple during
drawing,
a debate. Right?
So I wasn't watching the debate.
I mean, imagine how happy you are because you've been watching debate after debate after debate. Your brain is dying.
And then Apple comes up
Something and you good. Think, okay, maybe it's going to be one of the complaints that Jobs right. had about, you know, Obama or the way the government is keeping, you know, business out of America and all this stuff. No, no, no. So he did talk about that, but he talked about manufacturing and the idea that Apple has so many jobs overseas, the same stuff that we talked about in the New York Times article. So Santorum, this is his pet issue. You know, believe me, Santorum, what he wants to do is he wants to tailor laws to encourage the development of manufacturing here in the United States, and he wants to have everybody all happy in their family.
Whatever that means.
Families and manufacturing are his two big
issues.
What does
issues, that mean?
Okay?
How can he do that? He'll go house to house, say, huh?
Yeah. So if you've listened to him before, he talks about having, I believe, a 0% capital gains tax on corporations who create manufacturing jobs here in the United States. But I didn't really think about this before.
Apple.
But when you talk about what everybody else gets under his plan, they don't get the 0%. They get like 17%. I can't remember. You know, he has a corporate tax cut for everybody else. Mm-hmm. But he only gives the deep corporate tax cut to those people who have a choice about where they ship their jobs, whether it's here in the United States or overseas. So, for instance, if you're Starbucks and most of your jobs consist of baristas or cashiers or whoever is serving you coffee here in the United States, those jobs obviously can't go anywhere else because if I'm in New York City, I can't be served a Starbucks coffee by someone in China. I don't care how good an engineer they are or how cheaply they work,
teleporter,
right?
Teleporter.
So literally, he said in pretty much so many words, he said, oh, well, I don't have to give them as big a tax break because they can't ship their jobs overseas. I was like, what a horrible person.
Did anyone challenge him?
I can go ahead and soak the companies here, continue to soak them, not explicitly, no. And this is the thing. I mean, first
of
all, by this stage of the game, a lot of us, we tune them out. But if you really listen to what they're saying, I mean, that is a total jerk. I mean, if I'm at Santorum, I wouldn't even like him. I'd say, dude, what are you doing? First of all, you're picking winners and losers, and you have just openly admitted that you could give a bigger tax break to other corporations that create jobs only here in the United States and have no choice about it. But instead, you decide, okay, well, I'm only going to give the tax breaks when I have to lure them. It's really nasty and horrible. Ron Paul did say a good thing. He said, look, Apple benefits us even if it ships its jobs overseas. He understands. Sometimes he understands basic economics.
Yeah, sometimes it does. And it's good to have him there because, you know, we won't hear these things otherwise.
Martin is reminding us in the chat room here of Santorum's explicit attacks on the pursuit of happiness.
Absolutely right.
Yes.
That is scary stuff.
When he starts talking about the pursuit of happiness having to be reined in,
capitalism having
to work for everyone, he's an egalitarian.
Yes, I think about his own life. He didn't pursue happiness.
He doesn't look happy
at all, is what I'm saying. And he wants everyone to be as miserable as he is. And as president, he can maybe get that going. You know, it's like forcing families don't want to be together to be together. Husbands, wives, and
Chris.
And he has seven kids.
Chris also saw that video. He reminds seven kids. That would be hard.
He is he cannot keep his religion to himself, clearly.
Yeah, Chris in the chat room is reminding us of the video in which he says, listen, I don't believe in the pursuit of happiness.
I mean, it's just incredible.
How can he even let those words flow off of his tongue? The Constitution says,
endowed
with our Creator with inalienable rights.
It's pretty incredible.
Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
I think Gingrich actually used it, and I never heard him use it before. I think he used it. You know,
as a counter
absolutely.
To Santorum.
And he said it
certainly.
With conviction because as an American, you say that naturally. It rolls right off your tongue, naturally.
The other thing that I really hated about Santorum this week was when they went around asking that stupid question about what they would change in their campaign.
Okay, what was it?
And if you think about this, you've got Ron Paul, who has conducted so many campaigns, both for president, probably for re-election. Mm-hmm. He is a lot older. He's in his 70s. He's got tons of experience. And even he says, well, I wish I could express my ideas a little more clearly.
And again,
it's
almost endearing when you hear him say that, because it's true. He can't quite get it going. And, you know, it makes you like him a little. And then, of course, he goes insane with the foreign policy. But, you know.
I think I'm being corrected. Yeah, Declaration of Independence says that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
But, and,
not the Constitution.
About what's the name? What were we saying, though?
So about Santorum. They asked Santorum what he would change about his campaign. And he says he wouldn't change anything.
Mm.
Each of the other candidates would say, you know, Romney made a joke.
No,
and, you know, they'd all make some, at least some self-deprecating comments. And said, oh, I wouldn't change a thing. And I can't believe I'm in the final four. And it's really great. I don't know. He is maybe one of those politicians who leads a life that's insulated from the general public. So he doesn't really know how badly he's doing.
Probably.
I don't
probably.
Know.
He's so bitchy. It's like, damn. I mean, he's so, I guess, flat out. I mean, he's against the pursuit of happiness, right? So he never pursued his happiness. So I guess he married someone he didn't love. He has kids, even though he probably doesn't want kids. Well, that's what a family's supposed to be, right? You know, he's running for president, even though he probably doesn't want to.
And you said he's Catholic, so he doesn't believe in birth control.
I believe,
and that's why they have
I believe
all
he's Catholic. Yeah. That's my assumption. I don't know.
Immigration, they talked about again. And I like Gingrich's position on immigration.
What do you say explicitly?
He says that if somebody has been here in the United States working, a contributing part of the community for 20 plus years,
of course,
that person you would not deport.
Right.
Over, you know, and I think that's perfectly good.
Living on the dole, you know, that's not.
Yeah, and this is the way I think about it. If somebody has been living here illegally for 20 years, I defy you to say that that person has not been somebody who could have been detected by the government somewhere within those 20 years. Certainly they could have been found out. And our government has been playing this sort of, you know, let's not look. And it's almost a don't ask, don't tell sort of policy with regard to illegal aliens. It's really despicable because we haven't been enforcing the laws. And then all of a sudden these Republicans are all going to deport everybody.
No.
So I think of it along the lines analogous to a statute of limitations, that if you have managed to, obviously if you're a criminal and stuff, you're out. But if you've been here being productive, you have a job, you haven't been a huge tax on our, you know, economy all these years, you've been a contributing member of society, great. You know, you're out there working and stuff. I would say it would be bad to deport these people
Absolutely.
After 20 years. And so, you know, Gingrich, he admits that that's the policy. And I think the other candidates would have a hard time throwing these people out too. But if you ask Romney, dodges the question. Santorum, no, he's for enforcing the laws.
And that's the thing, you know, and that's why Gingrich is rising, because he's willing to say certain things ill guys would never say about the quote-unquote Palestinians, about the war we're waging,
about immigration.
So that's why Romney's inevitability is not no longer inevitable. I mean, that's why, because he will never say these things, ever.
I think Romney should adopt Gingrich's policies on both immigration and some
and you
of
know
his
what?
Knowledge about the Palestinians.
And he can do so and say, well, you know, because he always flips and flops. So, you know what I mean, he'll just do that. That's it.
Now, Romney's tax returns are going to come out this week.
Yeah.
So that's going to be another hurdle for him. Right. I'm glad he's releasing them sooner rather than later, assuming that they are an issue
but
for
again,
the election.
But again, you know, Rush Limbaugh said something that he should challenge. Well, I'll release them when Obama releases his college transcripts, his medical records, his, you know, and he should say that because they're not required to, but he should say that. But of course, again, Romney will never go hard against Obama the way he goes against his opponents right now. He just wouldn't. Doesn't have it in him. And I think Gingrich has the killer instinct. I think he has that, which is what you need against Obama, you know, just on that level alone.
Well, and that he would be willing to point out a lot of the facts about Obama's background
and
that other candidates
and also point
would
out what's
avoid.
Happening in the debate. If he's with Obama and they're going easy, and he'll point it out. Well, everyone knows to be true, but
calls out the media better than anybody.
Once you point out the truth, people love it, because we rarely ever hear the truth in these in these debates.
They talked about abortion for a while, but it's just too horrible and boring for me. So let me give you a summary of the so-called Final Four. I wrote this for an op-ed that I've submitted for review that I hope is going to get published, talking about the horrible state of the candidates. So I have a one-paragraph summary. You can, of course, pick out who each of these people is. Yeah, we have a candidate who, on issues of immigration and foreign policy, tells it like it is, as no other candidate does, but who seems to be a wild card otherwise, and in particular, doesn't seem like he will significantly reduce the size and scope of government rather than use it as a laboratory for trying out some of his interesting ideas. That's Gingrich. Romney, a candidate who, as governor, enacted what is essentially Obamacare at the state level, whose promise to repeal is accompanied with a promise to replace it with something almost as bad, and whose other policies allow for similar levels of government intervention in our lives. A third who wants government to intervene on behalf of manufacturing and families, whose only true conservative credentials are with respect to social issues, which will alienate voters. And fourth, who promises to make the sorely needed drastic cuts in the size and scope of government, but who is inconsistent when it comes to the protection of individual rights, and who advocates a non-interventionist foreign policy that, especially today, would be dangerous. So that's our four candidates in a nutshell. It's hopeless, and we'll just keep talking about it as time goes on. I got to go now, but during the week, check out my blog at don'tletitgo.com. You can follow me at Twitter at Amy Peekoff, and also follow the fun Ayn Rand bot for all of its cool quotations. Bosch's blog, as always, fosten.blogspot.com. Have a good night, everybody. Thank you for tuning in and for participating.
Thanks, everyone.
Goodbye.